Midine Amitzah, continuing in Shin Samech 390, that a non-Kohen should not worship in the Beis Hamikdash, and apparently we started this last time, but somewhere in the middle of this paragraph we are, and we're just gonna try to finish it quickly and get to some new material. Midine Amitzah, Masha'am Rizikharam Levracha, She'in Chiyuv Azharas Kareva Zo'ela, HaKorev La'avodah Mikol Avodah She'im Yuchadus La'Kohen. That it has to be something you do in the Beis Hamikdash that a non-Kohen does, that is required to be done by a kohen. That from the reception of the blood in a vessel, that's when the kohen has to start worshiping. He goes yitzikas belilos tenufos hagoshos, like when you pour or you mix the meal offering or you wave when you bring it to the altar. All these things. All these things to be done by a kohen. So if a zar does this and not going, then the korban would be invalid. There are those that are not included in this zara. So the malacha of shchita, shechting, is kosher if it's done by a non-kohen, even in the Beis Hamikdash. Which is very interesting. You think that a shechita is an intrinsic part of the kohen, but even so, since shechita is something that's done to non-sanctified animals as well, shechita is something that's required if anyone wants to eat any animal. So, since it's something that's in general can be done by non-kohanim, obviously you can have a regular shochet at Empire Poultry who's not a kohen, so that could also be done by a non-Kohen. It's interesting. This is actually related to last week's Parsha that talks about how in the Midbar, when the Jews were wandering in the desert, there was no such thing as chulin. There was no such thing as non-sanctified meats. All the meat that you wanted to eat had to be brought as a korban shlamim, which is the korban where blood sprinkled on the altar, but basically you get to eat all the meat. It's not a financial loss or anything, really. You get to enjoy the barbecue, but it's a korban. So in the desert, all the meat that you ate had to be in the context of a korban. It was only when the Jews came into Eretz Yisrael that they were allowed to stam shecht animals at Meal Mart or whatever, Solomon's, all these nice little factories outside of, not in the context of a korban. And they were now allowed to eat these things, but not in the desert. So the Netziv writes that maybe in the desert, a Kohen had to do Shechita as well, because there was no such thing as Shechita outside the Beis HaMikdash. And Shechita was only in the context of the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash, what was then the base of the Beis HaMikdash. So maybe the Shechita had to be done by a Kohen in the desert. It's interesting, Chiddush, that the Netziv writes. But if you look at Kodshim, even the holiest types of sacrifices, if a non-Kohen does the Shechita, the Kohen is perfectly valid. So also the lighting of the candles of the menorah. So if, again, the non-Kohen was not allowed to enter the building of the Beis HaMikdash, but assuming a Kohen took the menorah outside, and a non-Kohen lit the menorah on the outside of the Beis HaMikdash, so they could take the menorah back in, And that would be okay, because that's not considered a real avoda. It's interesting that by certain halachas, by Hanukkah candles, for example, you have a halacha called hadlaka osa mitzvah, that the mitzvah is fulfilled at the moment that you light the candles. So therefore, the candles must be in the correct position before you light them. So, for example, we know that a Hanukkah candle is not allowed to be more than 20 amos high, 20 cubits high. So if you light the Hanukkah candle higher than 20 amos, then you take the candle and you bring it down to within 20 amos. So that's possible. That's not a good fulfillment of the Hanukkah candles. But here, there is no such halacha that there is of the hadlaka osa mitzvah in the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash. It doesn't have to be lit in the correct place. It's interesting that the poskim, because a lot of the Gemara doesn't discuss nearly in depth the exact details about the halachos of Shabbos candles as it does regarding Hanukkah candles. So therefore, the poskim apply a lot of the rules of lighting Hanukkah candles to Shabbos candles. They assume, no, it's all candle lighting, it's all the same. So that's why, at least lechatchila, there is a rule of hadlaka osa mitzvah, that the Shabbos candles are supposed to be lit in the correct place, and they're not supposed to be lit, say, I don't know, in a room where you're not going to be using on Shabbos. It just happened to be easier to light the candle there and then moved into the dining room or moved into another room that you will be using on Shabbos.
If it's Yom Tov, and you're lighting, Erev Shabbos, and you're lighting then, normally when you take candle, light the stove and carry it over to the dining room, whatever it is. That, there's any problem with that?
Well, usually what you do in that case is that you light one candle from the stove, and then you light the other candle in the dining room. So halachically, you only need one candle, so that's not, that would not be a problem. But there is another issue if you're lighting candles on Yom Tov Sheni, say, second night of Yom Tov, or Motzei Shabbos, whatever, then the question is, do you really need to light Yom Tov candles at all? Because there's already enough light in the house. You have all the electric lights on already. So maybe you don't, it's really unnecessary to light Yom Tov candles at all. So therefore, a lot of people want to be machmir, that they want to light Yom Tov candles in a dark room. So maybe in such
you can't turn on the light.
On Yom Tov? On electric light? No.
Yeah. So if it's a dark room means the electric light is out.
Correct. So I'm saying some people when it's Yom Tov, it's the second night of Yom Tov, or Yom Tov falls in Motzei Shabbos, you can't turn off the correct practice really when lighting Shabbos and Yom Tov candles, regular Shabbos, is that you're supposed to make the bracha, you're supposed to turn on both the electric lights and the candles in honor of Shabbos. So you're supposed to say the dining room is dark, or turn off the lights in the dining room, and then you light the candles, and then you turn on the electric lights altogether, and you make a bracha on both, because the electric light should be part of the mitzvah of lighting candles, because it's because the electric lights are what mainly provides the light in this nowadays.
Say at the same time, what do you mean by the same time?
So either you light the candles first,
the
and then you should
on the
switch.
Table and the electric, the switch is like.
Well, you've already accepted Shabbos though, if you light the candles, but then you make the bracha.
No. You only accept Shabbos when you finish lighting all the candles that you're going to light.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So therefore, since the electric lights are included, so either you turn on the lights and you light the candles, you light the candles and you turn on the lights, then you make the bracha.
But once you
if you're a woman,
you
then you make
the
bracha after.
It's already Shabbos. You're not allowed to turn on the electric light.
No, but that's included in the candle lighting. That's part of the candle lighting. Just like if your woman has the minhag to light 40 candles in honor of Shabbos, so you're allowed to light all 40 candles.
And then you turn on the light?
And then you could turn on the light, yeah. Or you do the opposite, okay.
What if the light is on already?
What?
What if the light is on, for a while already? You have to turn it off and turn it on?
So Rav Soloveitchik was, I'm sure her husband could tell you, that Rav Soloveitchik was very makbid on this, you have to turn off the lights in the dining room and light the Shabbos candles and turn on the electric lights.
But once you light the Shabbos candles, it's Shabbos.
No, but the electric light is a candle.
Also, you haven't made the bracha yet.
You light the candles, but you didn't light the bracha.
Or do the opposite. If it makes you happier, do the opposite. You turn off the lights in the room, you turn on the electric lights, light the candles all immediately. It's all part of one hadlaka, one lighting of candles. And that's what you do. That's what you do. Or some Rav Yashiv liked. I thought of this myself before I saw Rav Yashiv said it. But okay, whatever. So Rav, it turns out that in order that the husband and the wife should both participate in the midst of lighting Shabbos candles, so he suggests that the husband should stand by the light switch, turn off the light should be off. Then the wife should light the candles in the dark room and make the bracha aloud. And bimotzi the husband. The husband says amen to the bracha and immediately lights the electric lights with his wife's bracha. So that way both the electric lights and the candles are included in the bracha, and both the husband and the wife get to participate in the mitzvah of Shabbos candles. So I don't usually get to do this because I'm not usually home when my wife lights candles because of my rabbinical duties. But when we're away for Shabbos, so I like to do that. My wife makes the bracha and lights the Shabbos candles, and then I turn on the lights.
Wait, you don't light it before she makes the bracha?
No, because for a man, you make the bracha before you light the candles. So on Yom Tov, so when you want to light the candles, so perhaps it's a better idea to light them in a dark room than move them to the dining room, even though you will not fulfill this idea of hadlaka utzimitzvah by the Yom Tov candles, rather than light the Yom Tov candles in an already lit room, which is, some poskim question as to whether that's really, you're allowed to do that at all, because there's a prohibition on Yom Tov called a ner shel batola. You're not allowed to stam light a candle because you feel like it on Yom Tov. It has to be some use for it. But some poskim feel that lighting a candle in an electrically illuminated room is a problem of Ner Shabbat Shel Batol, and you're not allowed to light Yom Tov candles at all. There's one... Yusker candles is a separate shayla.
Okay.
So there is one Chashuva Rebbetzin in Washington Heights, not mine. There is one Chashuva Rebbetzin, at least one, maybe more, at least one Chashuva Rebbetzin in Washington Heights who does not light candles when Yontif falls on Motzei Shabbos or on the second night of Yontif. Because she heard from her husband that you're not allowed to light candles on Yontif because it's already illuminated electrically, so it's not necessary. It's considered to be a Ner Shel Batala. But most poskim say, and obviously the strong minhag is like this, that it's not a problem in Ner Shel Batala because it's become such an intrinsic part of the ambiance of Yontif that that's considered a need, and therefore one is allowed to light candles even in such a situation.
But
yeah.
Also,
the prohibition there, Shabbat Tal, is not 100% clear. The Gemara seems to be a little wishy-washy on it, which is why, for this reason.
So
Shabbos candles, you're also lighting the Vatala because the electric light...
No, if Leontif is on Friday, then according to that, maybe you wouldn't be allowed to light Shabbos candles. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Leontif candles is more stringent than... Shabbos candles is more stringent than Leontif candles, yeah.
So in other words, you'd be so terribly shocked by the absence of your Leontif candles that
right.
would, you know, sort of...
Right, it's also part of the ambiance of the meal that you have candles burning there, so that's not considered to be Ner Shel Batala. There's all discussion regarding on Yontif, you're allowed to light a candle in shul. So a lot of shuls have the minhag that there you actually light physical candles in shul. It's considered to be part of the honor of the shul. So it's the same thing over here, that on Yontif, it's part of the honor of the Yontif meal that you're lighting candles in honor of Yontif. So if you have a timer... so then on the lights in your dining room. So what a lot of poskim recommend is that you should, again, this is if Yontif is on Motzei Shabbos, the second night of Yontif, then you should have the timer shut off the electric lights for a 15-minute window during the time, or however long, if you could be precise, more precise, you can be more precise, have it shut off the electric lights. Then the woman of the household during that window lights the Yontif candles in the darkness, and then a few minutes later, the timer is going to turn the electric lights back on. So if you have access to such a thing, yeah, it's a good idea. It sounds sticky, but halachically, it does seem to be a good idea. But if you don't have a timer in your dining room, so again, the very strong minhag and the consensus of the poskim is that one is allowed to light candles on Yontif. Yeah.
So a lot of women, most that I know, light an extra candle for each child. And is that a candle of Atolo?
No, if you're allowed to light one candle, you can light...
Because once you've lit two candles, you know, you've...
Well, light one candle, the strict, according to how the basic halacha, one candle is enough.
Uh-huh. So the additional candles don't matter as far as...
No. If you really hold, you're not allowed to light candles in an electrically illuminated room on Yontif, so then, yeah, each lighting of the candles is a separate avera. But if you hold that, you're allowed, so you're allowed to light as many as you want.
Either there is such an... You know,
different posts can hold different things. I'm telling you that the normative shita is not like that. But if you're going like this of Chashuva Rav in the neighborhood who told his wife not to light candles the second night of Yontif or when Yontif falls in Motzei Shabbos, so then according to him, then yeah, each candle would be a separate avera. Yeah.
Wait, so you're talking about the menorah, I think, going back to the...
Yeah.
Okay, right.
So the menorah... Yeah, so again, the menorah does not have this halacha of hadlaka as a mitzvah. It would be good, at least b'dieved, if a kohen brought the menorah outside the Beis HaMikdash, and then a kohen brought it back inside the Beis HaMikdash. V'yesh mehen arba avodos levad miuchados shein chamuro sheish ben chiyuv misa v'hein zrika v'aktara hakrava niso. So a person gets the penalty of misa b'dei shamayim if he does one of the three of the four avodos, which are, four, v'sheis v'chiyuv misa, v'shein zrika v'aktara hakrava nisoch. So sprinkling of the blood, the doing of the ktores, the burning of the pieces on the altar, and if you were to do a libation, either a wine libation or the special water libation on Sukkos, so then a non-Kohen who does such a thing would be liable to death at the hands of heaven. V'aleha ne'amar v'azara karev yumas. The person, a foreign person who goes to do it, will be put to death. Ruch Moshe Nisbar Maseches Yom Beperek Barishona Kol Mishu Rotzel Lisrom V'yoser Slovan Maseches Yom on that Perek V'yoser Pratea Mivorim Bisham Biyoma Perek Basra Maseches Vachem. Last Perek is Vachem as well. Benoigis was Zeb Bizharim and Kevos Bizman Abayis. It applies to males and females. If a woman does these things, even though only male Kohanim are eligible, so you might think that only a male Yisrael or a Levi would be liable to the penalty. No, but it applies to women also, that if a female did one of these avodos, then she would be liable to the penalty as well. Bizman Abayis, in the times of Beis HaMikdash, Bizman Azeh, Afal Pi Shehu Shamim Bavon Oseinu. If you would go up to the Har Habayis and you would do one of these avodos, doesn't have to do with the building of the Beis HaMikdash per se, but as long as you went up to the Har Habayis and you did one of these things, you would be liable to death at the hands of heaven.
So there are so many small, from my perspective, infractions for which the punishment is miso. And here in the same parsha, it says if you eat a novella.
Well, it's not the same parsha. This is Parshas Korach, it's in Bar Midbar.
Achremos, I'm talking about the one.
Yeah, okay.
If you eat novella, all you have to do is wash your clothing and take a shower and, yeah.
That's the Tumah V'Tara aspect. That doesn't address the tshuva and the Malkus aspect of it.
It doesn't say anything at all about any kind of punishment that has to be meted out.
The Torah doesn't always list all the consequences in every single place that it mentions a
because the way in which
prohibition.
It's kind of, you know, by the way, you eat novella, it's not so terrible because all you
have. No, that's like, so say the same thing. You say the same thing by in regarding Nida. In there's a difference between what it says in Parshas Mitzorah and Parshas Acharei, most.
Okay, my memory is
so missing. That in the Nida by when the way, it depends what the Torah is discussing. So in Parshas Mitzorah, so it says that if you have relations with Anida, so then her tumah is transferred to you. Not that she loses it, but that you a man adopts a tumah's Nida. Which is a man can be Anida. See, and we're very gender equality in halacha. A man can be Anida if he has relations with Anida, so then he becomes tummy for 7 days, just like Anida. Again, on a deraisa level, Anida is only tummy for a total of 7 days.
But if you eat novella, you
no. So then it just says by there. If you do that, so then you have to her tumah is transferred to you, and then you go to the mikvah. It doesn't say anything about the prohibition. It's only in the next parsha, the one we read yesterday, that said that includes nida amongst the list of the arayos, that the prohibited relationships. If you would just read parsha Mitzorah, you might think, hey, okay. You know, I'm willing to undergo the 7 day tumah. So sure, you know, I'm gonna. I don't want to go 7 days without being with my wife. So okay, I'll no problem. So I'll just go. I'll be with her, and then I'll wait 7 days, and I'll go to the mikvah. Who cares? If you would just read that parsha, that's what you would think. And if you would just read again, but then you have to learn the next parsha as well.
This is an interpretation. This is not the actual wording of.
Everything is interpretation. You read Lahavdil, War and Peace, you interpret it. You know, there's no such thing as. What do you mean? It says explicitly.
No, some places it's clearer than others.
Okay, but it says explicitly. It says explicitly in Parshas Mitzorah that her tumah is transferred to them. It doesn't say anything that you're not allowed to do it. It doesn't say anything.
There are two aspects to there. One of them is
exactly.
Onish, you know, and the other one is tumah. And
right, so even if you do it accidentally.
Mm-hmm. How could you accidentally eat?
No, I'm talking about you could accidentally eat treifus, of course, but if you accidentally with anida, so then her tumah, you receive the tumah. Then you there's less tshuva required. Again, depending on how exactly out of it you were and how much you could have been expected to prevent it, so that you require different levels of tshuva. But no matter what, even if somebody, you know, says hands you a package and says, here, take this to the post office, and it's a novella, and you carried it, so you're tummy because of the novella. You didn't do any avera at all. So it just discusses different things in different places.
You're tummy even if whatever it is you're carrying is wrapped.
Yeah.
It makes no difference.
Mm-hmm. Because you.
No difference.
Correct, yeah. There's two things. There's tumas maga, which only applies if you touch it, and there's tumas masa, which applies even if you. Even if you just carry it. Yeah. That was the whole question with the Muncie butcher thing. That the question was, the people who bought from Hatzlacha Grocery during the time of the Kasher scandal, So the question was, how much tshuva did they need? So there are three levels of sin. There's one that's a mazid, if you do it on purpose, then you obviously need heavy-duty tshuva. Then there's a shogeg, which means you didn't do it on purpose, but you still should have been more careful. You did something a little wrong, and that requires a lower level of tshuva. That's like when you have to bring a korban chatos. If you bring a korban chatos, let's say you violated Shabbos because you forgot that today was Shabbos. So you should have known that today was Shabbos. But there's also something called... So the question is, the people who bought from Hatzlacha supermarket did absolutely nothing wrong. They did nothing wrong. They bought with Hechsher. Or that's something that at the time was considered to be a reliable Hechsher. So they really did absolutely nothing wrong. If you eat from a questionable Hechsher and you say you hope it's good, so then we're talking maybe closer to shogeg. But if there's something where you really could have absolutely no, you really should, there's no other precaution that you could have taken or that you reasonably should have taken, so that's considered an even lower level of shogeg. Okay. Mitzvah Shin Sadi Aleph, Shelo Levatel Shmiras HaMikdash. We talked about before the requirement that you have to give the Beis HaMikdash an honor guard. That it's not for actual protection of the Beis HaMikdash. We're not worried about bandits coming and plundering the Beis HaMikdash, but you have to give the Beis HaMikdash an honor guard. Shelo Levatel Shmiras HaMikdash Alecha Svivo Tamid B'chol Laila. There was a positive commandment before that you're required to guard the Beis HaMikdash. Now it's saying a negative commandment that you're not allowed to neglect to perform the guarding of the Beis HaMikdash. Shenemar u'shmartem es mishmeres hakodesh. V'yadua shlozon shmira omeid b'makom lav. So it says that the k'mosh amr zichron l'racha b'kol makom shenemar yishomer pen val einu ala lo sase. That even if it doesn't say the word no, lo, you have to. There are other ways that the Torah can communicate that what it's conveying right now is mitzvahs lo sase, a negative commandment, which would carry with it the penalty of malchus and all of the ramifications of a negative commandment. That if it uses the language of pen, lest, the al, and also hishamer, that guard yourself, hishamer benega tzaras, things like that. We know that there's a positive commandment to guard the Beis HaMikdash. Ushmartem es mishmeres hakodesh adkan. Since it uses the word shamar, the shorash shin mem resh, ushmartem, that tells you that there's a lo saseh just like he shamar. The ulai darshu aseh velav, geshim tzushnei amikros, morim al davar echad. So even though it doesn't use the word hishamer exactly, it doesn't use the word lo. So the it says that maybe if you find two psukim that say more or less the same thing, and they're both phrased somewhat positively, so if you can darshan one to be conveying a negative commandment, so then you do so. Umeyoso sheva derech tzivoy lenochach lamdu halav, and the one that talks about in the second person, then that's the one you're going to be more inclined to kedarshan as a lo sasei. That tzivoy anistar shu kal mimenu. Darshu Basay. And so we know that a positive commandment is usually less severe than a negative commandment. So the one that's more indirect, Vishamru es mishmeres o'al moed, that they shall guard the Beis HaMikdash, is going to be less stringent. But when the Torah talks in the second person, you shall do this. So if there are two psukim say basically the same thing, so when it talks in the second person, so that's going to be darshaned as a lo sasei, even if though it doesn't use the actual phraseology that is normally associated with a negative commandment. V'chol shokel hadvarim b'mozne tzedek yode b'zesh anistar kal mitzivoy shehu lanochach. So anybody who can reasonably analyze these words will come to the understanding that a speaking in the second person is more severe.
Wait, could you just give an example of that? I got muddled somewhere in the middle here about third person versus second person, but that you, if it's second person, you then do it as a lotus.
I mean, I can't think of another example right now besides this one, but it says here, they shall guard the
okay,
temple,
so
and then that's more indirect, and then it says, and you shall guard the how do you say, mishmeres, the guardingness of the holiness.
That's what I don't get. How does it flip to a low?
It would be redundant. If it
because otherwise it would be redundant. And we know that also, especially, that the Shorash Shin Mem Resh, in a slightly different form, can be used to introduce a negative commandment, because as Hishamer. Again, it's a bit of a Cheshbon.
Shmer Shabbos, perhaps. That would also be
an example. Shamer of Nezal Shabbos?
Yeah.
Yeah, but there you have a negative commandment.
Yeah.
Lo sasecha malacha. You have a negative commandment explicitly, so there it's going to be a positive commandment. V'shamra v'nesel Shabbos. You have to keep Shabbos. Mishor she'a mitzvah im tzaz dineha kamish bada sefer kasu b'seder zeh mitzvah rishon. Again, that was a few mitzvahs ago, and we were talking about guarding the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, now we're going to switch gears completely. Everybody ready? Take a moment to breathe and clear your heads. Mitzvah Shin Sadi Beis, Mitzvah 392. Mitzvahs Pidyon Bechor Adam. The mitzvah of Pidyon Haben, the redemption of a firstborn child. Specifically a male child, but it doesn't say that explicitly right now. Lifdos Bechor Adam, Kilomar She Mitzvah Al Kol Ish Mi Yisrael She Yifte Min HaKohen. Beno shehu bechor leimo haYisraelis, that the mitzvah is on each Jewish man that he should redeem by giving money to a kohen the firstborn male child. That is, again, his mother is a Yisraelis, is a regular Jewess, as opposed to a kohenes or a levia, the daughter of a kohen or a levi. So assuming, again, the man is not a Kohen or a Levi, and the woman is not a Kohen or a Levi either, then there are other conditions to be fulfilled, then the father will be required to perform the Pidyon HaBen. Shenemar, Ach Pados Yivdez Bechor HaAdam. You have to redeem the firstborn of people. Again, there are redemptions that take place regarding firstborn animals, which we'll discuss later. But here we're talking specifically regarding people. Umatzanu b'makom acher shetola kosuv abechora bepeter rechem. That, so here I just say the firstborn child. So nu, maybe that means the father's firstborn child, maybe that means the mother's firstborn child, we don't know. But shenemar b'seder bo el paro, but it says in Parashas Bo, kol bechor peter kol rechem bivnei Yisrael. It means the one that opens the womb among the children of Israel. Ba'adum v'abeima lihu, that the holiness is only regarding a fetus that is born and opens the womb. Uhershu peta rechem, pesichas rechem, kolomar, shaya rishon liftoach rechem imo. So rechem, you can refer generally to a certain extent to the female reproductive tract. So it has to be both her first pregnancy that reached a certain point in the pregnancy, which we'll discuss, as well as it has to be a natural birth. It has to come out of the reproductive tract as opposed to being surgically removed. That if a child is born after the mother suffers a miscarriage, if the miscarriage causes the mother to be to receive the status of a yoledes, of a woman who has given birth, then that is considered to be her first child, and therefore the next child will not be required to have a pidyon haben. And the general halachic rule, again, there are details about exactly the form that the embryo or fetus has to have in order to be considered to be a full-fledged nephel or a full-fledged miscarriage that would exempt the next child from having a pidyon haben. Again, the Mishnayos and Nida go into detail about exactly how the discharged fetus has to look. But basically, the rule is that we know that before 40 days, that if the woman has been pregnant for less than 40 days, so that's considered nothing. In halacha, might be emotionally taxing. We don't want to dismiss that. But halachically speaking, less than 40 days is not considered a formed embryo, and therefore the mother will not be tamei regarding the status of a yoledes. So you have to remember also that the 40 days, there's the Yiddish way of calculating it and the Goyish way of calculating it. That the Goyish way of calculating the gestational age goes by the date of the last menstrual period. That's the way the convention is. So when you have if someone says that she's 6 weeks pregnant, that means it's been 6 weeks since she last got her period. It doesn't necessarily mean that conception doesn't mean in contemporary terminology that conception took place 6 weeks ago. In halacha, it does not go by this. It goes by the actual age of the embryo or fetus, meaning since the time of conception. And since we don't know generally exactly when the conception occurred, so you would generally go by the date of the last mikveh immersion. That the 40 days we calculated from the last mikveh immersion, because it's possible that the conception occurred on mikveh night. Yeah.
Does that mean that if you abort a child that is less than 40 days old from whatever, however you're counting, that's not counted as
my adama?
Possibly. Yeah, there is more leniency regarding a child that's not a fetus that's not 40 days old. Yeah. Yeah, it's a sugya. Yeah, there's a question is if that applies even to goyim also. We know that the rules regarding abortion are more stringent for goyim than they are for Jews, because in Judaism,
from a Jewish perspective,
right. So in terms of the sheva mitzvos b'nei noach, that we believe that that all human beings are required to follow. So one of the prohibitions in sheva mitzvos b'nei noach is murder. So in the general rule is that for Jews we have specific halachic definitions of things. So for example, someone is not considered responsible in general for his or her actions until the age of bar bas mitzvah. We have an age, 13, plus the physical signs that, and after that, a person is liable for the action. So by non-Jews, we don't have these shiurim. We don't have these specific halachic definitions. And therefore, a non-Jew is held to be liable for violating the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach as soon as they're judged by the court to be knowledgeable of their actions. It doesn't go by any particular age. We don't have these shiurim. So the same thing, so by for a Jew, again, it's I'm not going into the whole halachic discussion now of when is abortion allowed, when is it not allowed, but killing a fetus for Jews is not a capital offense. It's not considered absolutely like a murder, whether it's akin to murder, or like Rav Moshe Feinstein says, or famously the more lenient opinion of the Tzitz Eliezer, okay, regarding exactly what halachic categories abortion falls into, but in either case, it would be more lenient even for Jews before the 40th day. Again, exactly in what situations is a very complex topic. But for goyim, so there's no rule of fetus versus born versus not born. You age 13, not age 13. We don't go by the shiurim. So therefore, a non-Jew who kills a fetus is held to be liable for murder, because we don't go by these shiurim regarding non-Jews. The question is, even for non-Jews, if it's less than 40 days, is that a shiur of 40 days, or is it just because lemaisa is not considered to be even a real pregnancy before that time?
If the fetus is defective, known to be.
For Jews or for goyim?
When would Jews be in a position to judge goyim?
I don't think they have an abortion law which would have different rules for...
in the U.S., yes, but in halachic states, so maybe.
You say, look, you Catholics, you're right about Catholics, okay? I know.
They are, it's true. I don't know what they hold about the 40 days and what halacha...
No, there's absolutely some time of conception.
Right, so Taka, yeah, the Catholic Church is correct on this, yeah. Maybe with the exception of the 40 days, maybe. But,
it's hard to be saying that, you know, that somehow the Catholics are more firm than we are on these things, but, you know.
Well, the non-Jews in general, the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, are more stringent than they... Yeah. Uh-huh. So if the fetus is defective, it has a major problem. So there are post-kim hold that, since for the Tzitz Eliezer, since it says that for Jews it's not a prohibition, a murder-like prohibition... So then perhaps if the mother is extremely distressed over the situation of the child, then there are poskim who do permit it. Because the mother's it wouldn't be murder-like according to that approach, so then the mother's mental health considerations may override the prohibition of abortion. But under normal circumstances, it's not permissible, even for Jews, for sure not, according to all the poskim.
Even if the child is less than 14.
Again, most women don't seek abortions if they're not seriously, or don't have seriously, don't think it's going to seriously affect their mental health. But, okay, yeah. But the question, it's a very big halachic issue. It has to be consulted. It has to be dealt with by a very very heavy-duty halachic authority if there are any shilas of abortions. But for non-Jews, yes, the mother's mental health would not play into it. Okay. So, unless it was, again, but even for non-Jews, it would be permissible if the fetus posed a danger to the mother's health, physical health, then it would be permissible even for them. Fine. So, after 40 days, if the miscarriage occurred after 40 days, then, again, if you're not sure that if it's been 40 days yet, then the pidyon ben of the next son, if that were the case, would be performed without a bracha. But if you know for sure that the fetus was fully formed in halacha, then the next child would be exempt from a pidyon ben. And there's also a difference regarding hilchos nida as well, that if a woman unfortunately suffers a miscarriage after 40 days and she does not yet know whether the baby is a boy or a girl, or if she knows it's a girl, then she has to observe the period of separation that corresponds to the birth of a girl, which is 14 longer. Days. So we hold, even under normal circumstances, so if a woman becomes a nida, so she waits, again, this is she waits at least 5 days or until she stops bleeding, and then she waits the 7 clean days. So that is automatically going to be after the period of Tumas Yoledes that follows the birth of a boy, because the birth of a boy is 7 days total. But it's a very interesting situation, again, very, very sad situation, but this is a case where the deoraisa rule is more stringent than the minag, if you could phrase it that way, because after the birth of a girl, a woman is not allowed to go to the mikvah for 14 days. So in this case, it's possible that she could observe the 5 days and then the 7 clean days, and that's only 12. Mm-hmm. So under normal nida circumstances, she's allowed to go to the mikvah right away. But now mi deoraisa, again, if she had a miscarriage over 40 days and there was a potential that it could have been a girl, midel raisa, she has to wait an extra 2 days to go to the mikvah, which is very interesting. And obviously, then sometimes there are leniencies regarding regular nida, regarding that you would be allowed to go to the mikvah before tzeisa kochavim in certain circumstances, even when it was just later in the day. Again, very rare leniencies, but there. It's possible to talk about such things regarding regular nida, but regarding this situation where a woman stops bleeding within the time frame of a girl and she has to wait midaraisa to go to the mikvah until the night of the 15th day after the 14 days have completely passed, then she obviously has to wait midaraisa until it's tzeisa kochavim in order to go to the mikvah. That's a very, it's just an interesting halachic case. Whereas if the miscarriage occurred before 40 days, you knew for sure that it occurs before 40 days, then even if you had some way of knowing that the fetus was certainly a girl, the embryo, I guess, called at that point, then that's not considered to be a birth, quote-unquote, halachic birth at all. What do you mean? Most people don't.
If it's very early, it's very early in development. Unless you go to 38,
right. You have to do a chromosome check in order to know that early, yeah. So in such a situation, if the miscarriage is that early, so then the woman is treated just like Nida, even if you know for sure it's a girl and it was miscarried under 40 days, then there would be no requirement to wait the 14 days, and as soon as she counted the Shiva Nikiyim, then she would be allowed to go to the mikvah. Okay, but again, so if the woman is considered to be a yoledes, again, unfortunately, it's a very sad situation, but the halacha does not distinguish regarding tumas yoledes, if it's over 40 days, whether the child is born alive or rachmana litzlan not born alive, then the next child would not be a bechor for the pidyon haben purposes. But there are times where you might ask a woman who's having her first child, You know, and she knew that she's not a Kohen and her husband's not a Kohen, or a Levi, and she didn't have a C-section. You say, no, so not only a bris, mazel tov, not only a bris, but a pinyon of ben also. No, you know, it's not a pinyon of ben, so...
That's pinyon of ben about the bracha then, right?
Well, in order to avoid herself the embarrassment of saying, well, first of all, a miscarriage is not embarrassing. It happens to happens to a very high percentage of people, but most people don't want to publicize that that fact. So yes, you have a pinyon of ben without a bracha just to cover up for the fact. Okay, that's a little strange. Most people, I mean, maybe some people do that, but that's not... people notice that no bracha was being said unless you slur the bracha. It seems a little odd, but it's not a good policy. A lot of people do this when people have their first child and it's a son, and they say, you know, they say, oh, no, so pidyon haben also. Just not a good idea to say that, just in case it's in fact not a pidyon haben. Fine. Fine, but if it's less than 40 days, so then the next, if a son is born next, then there will be a pinyon event. Let's explain the Maseches Nida. Maseches Bechor is bar kimochein eze bechor lakoin velo lanachalo bechor lanachalo velo lakoin v'gam v'rsham sheish bechor lakol v'yesh eino bechor la'elcha mehem. So he said there are two different areas in halacha where a bechor is relevant. One is for pinyon aben. And one is for receiving the double portion of inheritance. And there are situations where some will be both a pidyon haben and for the inheritance. There'll be situations where someone is not a bechor either for the inheritance or for the pidyon haben. So the basic chiluk that's between the bechor for the inheritance versus the bechor for a pidyon haben is one goes by the mother, one goes by the father. Simple. That if a woman is divorced or widowed, and she has many. She has 14 children from her first husband, and then she marries a second husband who has no children yet, and then they have a child together. So that child will be a bechor regarding the husband's estate, because it's his first child. But that will obviously not be a bechor regarding the pidyon haben. But the pidyon haben completely goes by the mother. So let's say a man. Again, same thing. Divorced, the widowed. He has 14 children from his first wife, and then he gets married to a second woman, and she has her first child. It's her first child, and then he'll make a pinyon event. So it has nothing to do with the husband at all. There's actually, I know, there's at least one person who's made it to pidyon haben. You think it's people call it a once in a lifetime mitzvah, but it's not necessarily once in a lifetime mitzvah. He was married, had a boy first. He got divorced, married again. Had a boy first, made two pidyon. Actually, that's only his two kids. Actually, so he had two kids, two pidyon. That's a pretty high percentage. No, it's a pretty pretty high percentage. But it does not go at all. Or if, you know, in times where this is permissible, if you have more than one wife, if a man has 10 wives and they all give birth to a baby boy first, maybe at the same time, maybe they're all on the same day, you can make 10 pidyon haben on the same day. It has absolutely nothing to do with the husband. It only has to do with the wife. I remember I was talking to someone. And I invited them to Sachi's Pidyon Haben. And he says, oh, this is your first child? Oh, I didn't know that. I thought you had already. So I was really tempted to respond. I restrained myself, but I was really tempted to respond. I didn't say anything about my first child. It's my wife's first child. That's all. Pidyon Haben has nothing to do with the father at all. And then there are situations where you'll be a bechor for both, obviously, if it's both the husband's and the wife's first child. By the way, I'm talking about a husband and a wife, but obviously this is not permissible, but if a child be born out of wedlock, he would also be required to undergo a pidyon haben. Sure. Yeah. And there is someone who's a bechor for neither the kohen nor for pidyon haben, which is a child who's born by C-section. Mm-hmm. That pet the rechem means that it has to come out from the rechem, from the reproductive tract. So if it's a C-section, then it's not a bechor for either one. That will not. And not only that, so there is a shita in the Mishnah that if a woman has a child by a C-section and then subsequently has a child by a natural birth, so the second child would be a pidyon haben.
Oh, wow.
Because that's the child. We don't pass him like that. Mm-hmm. We don't pass him like that. But that the idea is that that is the first child of that that opened the reproductive tract. So therefore, that would be a pediatric. Again, we don't know like that, but that's just an interesting just interesting how far you take this idea. There's also a shita. It's interesting that if a woman converts, so the Mishnah records a shita that, let's say, the woman had already five children when she was not Jewish, and then she converts, then her first child after the conversion will be liable for a pidyon haben. We don't paskin like that either, but since it says that this shita bases itself, I think it's the shita of Rabbi Yossi, bases himself on the fact that it says, Kadesh li kol bechor, peter kol rechem bivnei Yisrael. The first exiting of the womb of the children of Israel. So before she wasn't Jewish, now she's Jewish, so it's her first Jewish child. So that's the story also. And even if a woman is having her first child and she converts while she's pregnant, now also that would be, even though the child was conceived as a non-Jew, since the child is born as a Jew and it's the mother's first child, that would be liable for a pidyon haben. It's also interesting that we know that a whether the mother or the father is a Kohen or Levi, so you're liable to have a, you're exempt from a pidyon haben. So let's say what happens when a Kohenes or a Levia is impregnated by a non-Jew. So what happens? So for a regular Jewish woman, so that is chayav in pidyon haben because it goes by the mother. It's a Jewish child. It's the first, again, there's no father to perform a daughter of a kohen. Oh. So there's no father to perform pidyon haben, but when the child grows up, so he himself will have to perform his own pidyon haben. The mother is also not obligated to perform pidyon haben. It's only the father or the child himself. So that's obvious. But if a non-Jew conceives a child with a female Kohen, Kohenes, then the child is required to have a pidyon haben. Why? Because once she has relations with a non-Jew, she loses her Kedusha.
Yeah.
So therefore, which is not the case, very interestingly enough, if a Levia, if the daughter of a Levi is as relations with a non-Jew and becomes pregnant, so her child will be exempt from a pidyon haben. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to hear that the Levi seems to be more stringent than the Kohen. Usually things are because a Levite woman has no halachic ramifications, other than the fact that she can't marry a Kohen now in the future. She herself has no halachic ramifications from the fact that she had the relations with, again, it was an Avera, okay, but it doesn't affect her status in the future much, mm-hmm. that she had relations with a non-Jew, and therefore she will be required, that she will be exempt, I'm sorry, from a pidyon haben with her first child was with a non-Jew. All these interesting cases. You have also, again, this idea, so the C-section is not a bechor at all. It's not even if it's both the first child of the father and the mother, then if it's, by the way, there's also a raya, the thing I was telling you before about you read in all the Goyish literature that, thousands of years ago, 2,000 years ago, C-sections, women didn't survive C-sections. That they would, C-sections would only be performed if the mother was dying anyway and they just wanted to save the child. So they would cut open the mother's abdomen and they would take out the child, so at least the child should survive. So you see here from the Mishnah. The Mishnah says explicitly, it relates it as a regular fact of life. Yeah, if a woman has a C-section and subsequently delivers naturally, then they'll both be exempt from pidyon haben. Again, I don't know if it happened so frequently, but it was. Mm-hmm. There's no indication anywhere that was something that was so crazy that that never happened.
Julius Caesar's mother, the original one.
Yeah.
Well, all I know in history, whatever I said, that the mothers.
So maybe the Jews had more advanced technology, and somehow they allowed the mothers to survive.
Yeah. What about interesting? It's with the Hilchas Nida. Sometimes there is something called false pregnancy, where there's no cells there, but it's
right. So sometimes the. Right, so the embryo will be absorbed very early on, and the gestational sac will continue to develop, and the but if you do an ultrasound, you look inside, and there's no embryo.
Right.
So that would not be there would not be any tumor cellulitis in that point, even if it was the pregnancy was over. It goes by the age of the embryo. It doesn't go by the age of the what you call the pregnancy. So that would not be tumor cellulitis. Also, if a woman has a C-section, then she's not subject to tumor cellulitis. Tumor cellulitis is only if it comes out naturally. So if a woman has a girl by a C-section, then again, in theory, she as soon as she completes her shivanikiyam, even if it's before the 14 days, so she could go to the mikvah. But again, we're by a regular full-term birth and not a miscarriage, it's extremely, extremely, extremely rare for a woman to complete the shivanikiyam before the 14 days. It usually takes several weeks. So
the first child is a girl and it's a C-section. Then the second child is a natural delivery and it's a boy. So then that's
no pidyon haben.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What did you say? No pidyon
haben. Mm-hmm. The child is a C-section. Yeah, I know someone who had this actually in the neighborhood, an acquaintance. That the first child was a girl C-section, and then the second child is a boy, natural. Then there's no pidyon haben. Correct. We hold that it has to be both the first child and the first child that exits naturally. Has to be both. So this has relevance in terms of the nachala as well, that if you're talking about inheritance, so sometimes there are families that want to avoid the halachic requirement that the firstborn son gets a double portion because it'll cause strife with the family, whatever, so you want to avoid this halacha. So you want to do a halachic will. Everyone should do a halachic will. Okay. So this actually happened to me once, that somebody came to me wanting to execute a halachic will because they have two sons and they don't want the firstborn to get a double portion. So they want to do a halachic will that circumvents the halachic inheritance, the standard Torah inheritance. So I said, you don't need to. Why? Because they only had two sons, and they were born by C-section. So I said, there's no bechor in this case. So your halachic will is going to be the exact same as what the Torah would dictate anyway for the inheritance. That would apply the same if a family had five sons and they were all born by C-section. So then, or for even just the first one was born by C-section, then you wouldn't need a halachic will at all because the firstborn would not receive a double portion of inheritance anyway. There's also a question by C-section regarding something that happened recently, the fast of the firstborn. Tainis Bechoros and Erev Pesach. So does a C-section have to fast for Tainis Bechoros? What do you think?
It seems no.
So it's a Machlokis and the Achronim. It's a disagreement. Again, this is Tainis Bechoros is a Minag, so it's not like Pidyon HaBen. We have to figure out exactly what's going on Midaraisa. But the question is, in Mitzrayim, the Tainis Bechoros is a remembrance of the Makas Bechoros, right? So in Egypt, did the Kodesh Baruch Hu kill during Makas Bechoros the Egyptian firstborns who were born by C-section? Well, tell me the answer. What's the answer?
Well, it says, Ein Ba'yisai
Asher. Oh, excellent! Yes!
Sorry, say that again.
It says in the pasuk that there wasn't a house where there wasn't a dead body found. Yeah. So it seems.
Excellent. Yes. Right. So the the bechor for Makas Bechorot in Egypt was the firstborn. No matter how it didn't matter how the firstborn was delivered. It was,
but the pharaoh was a firstborn and he was spared.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a different. Okay. But the. So the C-section firstborns were killed in Makas Bechoros. So then as a remembrance of that, the oldest in each household should fast Tainis Bechoros as a remembrance of that. But other poskim say, no, because it's not a direct link to exactly who was a Bechor in Egypt is now. In Judaism, a Bechor who's born by C-section has no status of a Bechor at all. So in time, it's now that we've turned this into a Jewish observance, as opposed to just a copying exactly what was done in Egypt. Since it's a Jewish observance, and we call it Tainis Bechoros, the firstborn. So since you don't have the status of the firstborn at all in Judaism, so therefore you don't have to fast. Okay, but what's obviously the practical recommendation? You go to a Siyum, no? You go to a Siyum like everybody else does Erev Pesach. So the C-section firstborns also should go to a Siyum on Erev Pesach. Okay, so we'll continue with the Dinei HaMitzvah next week, Ritz Hashem.